KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. We're still absorbing the terrible news from Thursday night. Las Cruces Public Schools Superintendent Dr. Karen Trujillo was hit and killed by a minivan while walking her dogs. Trujillo was 50 and formerly headed the State Public Education Department. A Las Cruces police statement says the minivan driver stopped and was cooperating with police. Trujillo recently talked with us about the losses the district has suffered during the pandemic.
You know, we've lost multiple staff members starting in November. And when we look at the impact that all of the educators, teachers, substitutes, educational assistants that we've lost in the past few months, it's devastating because each of them has touched hundreds, if not thousands, of lives, both with their colleagues, but also with students. You know, as hopeful as we are looking forward, we really do have to recognize that there are many, many pieces to the puzzle that we have to take into consideration.
Word of Karen Trujillo's death spread quickly through Las Cruces and prompted tributes on social media from many. Trujillo was married and had three children. She was also a former classroom teacher, school principal, and administrator at New Mexico State University. New Mexico health officials say the delay in getting more people vaccinated is due to their efforts to be more equitable and coordinated. But a growing number of New Mexicans are deciding not to wait, heading to Texas instead, including KUNM's Zaylee Pollan.
Like hundreds of thousands of other New Mexicans, I signed up for the COVID vaccine as soon as I could. That was several months ago. Then I heard about a growing number of people going across state lines to Amarillo, Texas, to get their vaccine sooner. What was it about their system that was allowing so many more people to get vaccinated? I decided to head to Texas myself to find out. The drive from Santa Fe to Amarillo is just over 4 hours of long, flat highway. When we reached the convention center, we saw a line of people forming outside the front doors. And in the cold air, I wondered how long we'd be waiting outside. But to my surprise, it was only minutes. And those with disabilities were shepherded to the front of the line. Currently, the Amarillo Health Department is asking that only those in 1A and 1B categories come to the center. Once inside the door, nobody was asking for status or health details. We filled out some paperwork, then shuffled toward a large room where hundreds of people were seated in socially distanced chairs. A man named Justin was to my left. He had just arrived that morning on a red-eye flight from Los Angeles. At 42, he was low on the list for a vaccine, despite having a serious health condition.
I came here because a friend told me that they were offering a place to get vaccinated and that they had more openings in terms of who qualified, and I qualified. I have a late-stage non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I wasn't sure if I was going to get in today, so I rented a room. But in the event I do get a vaccine today, then I'm going to head home because I just don't want to be around anybody at this point.
With your health condition, you weren't able to get vaccinated in California?
No, right now they're limiting vaccines to frontline workers and people in long-term care facilities.
On the other side of me was Tommy Tompkins, who at 100 years old was lined up for his second shot. He drove up from the nearby town of Canyon to make sure COVID is not the illness that was going to take him out.
Glad to be here. Glad to get it. Sure hope it's effective for everybody.
When I arrived at the check-in desk, I offered my paperwork to a nurse named Jackie with the Amarillo Health Department. She told me she had checked in dozens of people from New Mexico and even further afield.
We've had from New York, we've had Minnesota, Massachusetts, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Mexico, California, Colorado, Louisiana, everywhere. They're coming from everywhere. They're literally flying in, getting their shots, and then going home.
And then are they able to get their second shot at home, or do they have to come back?
Nope, they can get their second shot in their area as long as they offer the same Moderna that we have now, or they're welcome to come back here if need be, so either way.
The vaccine itself took only minutes, after which we were asked to spend 15 minutes in the recovery room, just in case we had any adverse reactions. Jose Garcia with the Amarillo Fire Department sat at a table answering people's questions, ready to respond if medically needed.
I think the reason why a lot of people are coming to Amarillo, especially from the New Mexico, Oklahoma, Colorado areas, is we're one of the few walk-in clinics that are available that people can actually just walk in and get their vaccine without having to have an appointment. And so and that's why our numbers have been through the roof right now. And the state is recognizing that. And so they're allocating more doses towards us to get more people vaccinated. You do not have to have an appointment to have your vaccination. As long as you meet the criteria of group 1A or 1B, then you're allowed to come in and get your shot.
So this seems really smart and sensical. Why aren't more areas doing this?
That I have no idea. Because I've talked to several people, they're 8, 9, 10 months out before they can even get their first shot through the appointment process.
As I walked out of the observation room, I saw Justin sitting against the wall, furiously tapping away at his phone. He was buying a plane ticket back to LA for that afternoon. You know, it's ironic, he told me. I was born in Texas, then left to do my undergrad in LA. Now I'm coming back home, hoping Texas can save my life. For KUNM, I'm Zaylee Pollan.
And vaccination is urgent for so many reasons. New COVID-19 maps released this week ended indoor dining in Doña Ana County once again. Counties operating now at the state's red level, in addition to Doña Ana, are Eddy, McKinley, and Otero counties. Doña Ana County had reached the yellow level with a positivity rate of around 4.3% February 10th, but regressed with a current positivity rate of nearly 6.8%. Las Cruces Public Schools resumed some in-person learning this week, but most students are still at home. KRWG intern Sarah Rodriguez has more on how the online classroom has been a big adjustment.
Las Cruces Public Schools has been continuing a remote learning model for classroom instruction. The new virtual classrooms were a learning experience for teachers. Centennial High School teacher Beth Rewalt describes how she has adjusted to her virtual classroom.
I feel like I've adjusted well. I feel very comfortable with Canvas, which is our online learning platform. I feel like I've learned and found ways to try to engage students in this unconventional style of teaching and learning.
According to Rewalt, the initial issue that teachers struggled with was online participation from students.
Initially, it was just getting kids on Zoom. So it was really hard to get the students to log into the Zoom sessions. There were no requirements for attendance, and there still aren't. But once I could get the word out that we're actually doing something that's engaging and maybe even fun, and you're actually learning something, I started to get, my attendance got a little bit better.
Remote learning reduces the opportunities for hands-on learning experiences. The challenge has been finding ways to supplement hands-on learning at home, says Rewalt.
I think academically, I'm a science teacher, so the interactivity of the things that we did in the classroom, that's been really difficult to not have. So hands-on engagement opportunities are super valuable in the learning process for most kids, especially in science. And so this has been missing for the most part.
Remote learning also poses additional challenges when it's your first year of teaching. Alyssa Flores describes what her main struggle was during her first semester as a teacher.
That was probably the thing I struggled with the most in the beginning, is trying to get them to come out of their shell, turn their cameras on, talk to me. And still, it's an everyday struggle, but they've gotten better.
Flores has focused on establishing trust and support with her students.
It's hard to tell kids, like, advocate for yourself, reach out to me, email me, contact me. It's easier said than done, I guess. And so a big thing for me has been, like, communication. Some of these kids are going through the unthinkable. And so just trying to be that one thing that's going to be solid for them is really important.
After an entire semester of online instruction last fall, students like Mateo Garcia Bryce knew what to expect for the spring semester.
Last semester, it was relatively easy just because we were still getting used to it. We were still getting the hang of it. And this semester has pretty much been the same, except they've taken off, you could say they've taken off the guardrails, right? So it's a little bit more difficult, more rigorous.
Even though remote learning has its challenges, Rewalt describes some of the positive skills that remote learning can provide to students.
If a student is struggling with organizational skills, remote learning is probably good for them, because in Canvas, everything's very organized. You know when your due dates are, all your assignments are in one place. You don't have to worry about losing a paper or, you know, forgetting to write down some data in class that you need to go home and crunch numbers for. So I feel like if you struggle with organization, you probably benefited from remote learning.
Although this school year looks different for students, teachers are continuing to have a positive outlook on the situation, says Flores.
really, it kind of gets better every day. I think the kids, it's hard for them, you know, it's not ideal for them, but I know that they come and they're looking forward to seeing me, and I've been having really good attendance lately, and I just try to keep the energy really high and try to be really positive for them.
Students and teachers will continue to adjust to this new style of education. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Las Cruces Mayor Ken Miyagashima gave the State of the City address this week, highlighting how the city has worked to overcome pandemic-related challenges. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The state of our city is strong. In the face of adversity, we have come together powerfully as a community with renewed purpose and eagerness for the future.
The mayor called attention to various pandemic efforts during his State of the City address, including the authorization of city funds for pandemic-related assistance. This month alone, the city approved $977,000 of additional funding, helping to provide resources for programs like food initiatives and emergency shelter operations.
I tried my best to harmonize emergency guidelines with medical consensus, the best thinking of my fellow council members, and mandates from the state. Working with area nonprofits, the council authorized approximately $3 million in city funds for COVID-related needs, working directly and through area nonprofits to provide food, rent, mortgage, utility, and medical assistance for area residents.
According to Miyagashima, one of the top priorities going forward is creating opportunities for Las Cruces residents to obtain greater financial freedom. The city is already working on both educational and workforce development, but the mayor stressed the need for an increased focus on local wealth creation.
I recently asked that our new strategic plan call on the Economic Development Department to develop a component dedicated to local wealth creation. One task of this initiative would be to help local entrepreneurs start or expand their own enterprises, especially those that produce goods and services that we are currently buying somewhere else. We want to provide our businesses better access to local capital.
Miyagashima shared the city is working to cultivate greater personal wealth by expanding home ownership opportunities. In the last 2 years alone, the median cost of residential listings has risen by approximately $30,000, raising questions of affordability for residents. Now the city plans to target current zoning codes to spur construction of different housing options, such as duplexes and triplexes. He stressed the importance of financial security, saying that investing in opportunities to generate local wealth will lead to greater prosperity for future generations.
Creating local wealth leads to the intergenerational transfer of wealth within our community, helping our children gain a financial foothold in their own lives. We need to open the doors of prosperity to all of our residents, so that building wealth is an activity of the many and not just a few.
The mayor also reaffirmed the city's commitment to establishing a behavioral health district, a project previously outlined in the last State of the City address. The district would help to organize service needs related to mental health more effectively.
Last year, in the State of the City address, I talked about the creation of a behavioral health district in our area. Though slowed somewhat by COVID and the many pressing needs it created in our community, we are still fully committed to the better coordinating the behavioral health efforts of the county, city, public schools, and area municipalities.
Miyagashima ended his address by thanking city councilors and pledging his commitment to ensuring a bright future for the city of Las Cruces.
We are thankful for every one of you in this special community. Personally, I'm especially grateful to share this precious life with you and the opportunity to serve as your mayor.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
To state politics now, and this week we hear from District 37 Democratic State Representative Joanne Ferrari of Las Cruces. Representative Ferrari talked with Anthony Moreno about legislation she's working on this session.
Representative Ferrari, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you join us. Of course, this is a busy legislative session. The pandemic has impacted New Mexico so much. I want to talk with you a little bit about that briefly here as we start. Many folks have participated during these sessions that have been online, the committee sessions that have been held mostly online. The leadership in the New Mexico House from the Democratic side released some information that said over 6,100 New Mexicans from almost every county have participated in committee meetings this month alone. Over 32,600 people have watched the legislature online at the website.
I think it's amazing that so many people are able to access making public comment, listening in. Our committees are organized where we can have polls and see who in the audience and watching can, you know, say if they support or they oppose, a different issue or bill. And then to take public comment from people from all over the state has really been amazing to give a voice to everyone. Unfortunately, there are still those who don't have broadband and won't be able to participate, but we're hoping that more and more people will be able to, even in the last month of this session, be able to give comment and let us know how they feel about a different bill. So I think it's been great. We are able to make sure that people are heard, that they can weigh in on the issue, and that we hear them.
Okay, I want to move on and talk about some legislation that you're sponsoring. One is House Bill 7, the bill to repeal the abortion ban in New Mexico. The state Senate has already passed a version of this bill, Senate Bill 10. Uh-huh. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this bill and why you feel it was necessary to be passed in New Mexico.
Well, it's been important for the past few years, especially with the past presidential administration, because of the appointments of the Supreme Court justices being more conservative and the threat of Roe v. Wade falling or being reduced. And so we have been trying for the past, 3 or 4 years to pass this bill. And all it does is nothing changes. It stays the same. We're just repealing three sections that would make it so that we didn't have safe and legal abortion in New Mexico. And this is important to respect, the decisions of women for their full health care and for the health care providers not to be criminalized. And this is something that I think has been critical and very important to a lot of people, constituents, legislators in our state.
The last time we talked on your legislators, I believe it was a couple of years ago, this bill actually failed in the legislative session. It failed in the Senate. What do you think the difference was this time with the Senate passing it?
Well, with those votes that were taken in the Senate, it identified the senators who were in opposition, and especially the Democratic senators. And so we had lots of women who rallied around different primary candidates and to win those seats eventually, even in the regular general election.
I want to talk with you a little bit more about that political fallout. You said nothing changed in New Mexico with this issue, but some may say that it was this piece of legislation that changed the New Mexico Senate. Do you think that's the case?
Oh, yes, most definitely. What I mean is if this bill passes, nothing will change in New Mexico. It will stay the same. We're just, making sure that we show the protection and the respect to women and to the healthcare providers. But yes, most definitely, it was a political issue during the primary and the general election. Because it's that important to women and the men who love and care about their family and their situation.
New Mexico State Representative Joanne Ferrari. You can watch that entire interview at krwg.org. El Paso County commissioners are asking for federal help for the health and safety of migrants and asylum seekers released into U.S. border communities during the pandemic. The commissioners passed a resolution this week calling on the Biden administration to provide resources and come up with a plan for COVID-19 testing and other care. County Judge Ricardo Samaniego read from a letter to the new Homeland Security Secretary.
We know that the collaboration and assistance of the federal government, we will be able to meet the challenges of receiving migrants and asylum seekers at the border with dignity and in a way that guarantees the health and safety of everyone.
Last week, the Biden administration began allowing some asylum seekers who were placed in the Remain in Mexico program to enter the U.S. after receiving COVID-19 tests in Mexico. But a public health order that closed the border to most migrants remains in effect. Well, of course, the big news across the state of Texas over the last 2 weeks has been the massive power outage that occurred. A former congressman whose district included part of the El Paso area is speaking out about that debacle. Millions of Texans were left without power and water after the storm. Former Congressman Will Hurd told Meet the Press it was a problem that was 100% preventable. Hurd, a former CIA undercover operative, says the country's enemies are watching.
They're looking at how that the grid was able to fail, and they could potentially use this and have a cyber attack to do this kind of thing.
Hurd says these are conversations state and federal leaders should be having while still ensuring future reliable and cheap energy sources. Well, the winter storm, of course, has also affected so many, many lawmakers who have been meeting about this issue in Texas. They're beginning to ask why this happened as they try to figure out how to prevent disasters like this in the future. During a press conference this week, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said that he will spearhead this effort.
I'm taking the responsibility of the fix on my shoulders as the president of the Senate. I'm not going to take a bill that doesn't get the job done, whatever that is. We're working on the short term and the long term. We're not going to have people look back at this 10 years, 20 years from now and say, well, in 2021, they knew and they didn't fix it.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott also saying that this was unacceptable and he will expect a solution from legislators. State hearings on the power outages started on Thursday. Well, of course, many Texas schools were closed this week due to cleanup from the winter storm. The Texas Education Commissioner says it's going to take at least a month to survey damages schools sustained during the severe winter weather. Mike Morath updated state lawmakers during a House Budget Committee hearing this week.
The storm damage, we don't yet have survey data back from our school systems on the nature of like how much plumbing repairs, how much damage it's going to be. I have every reason to believe it's fairly extensive.
The Texas Education Agency is not requiring schools to make up days they missed during the blackouts. TEA is also allowing districts to stay closed or completely remote to finish repairs. The recent problems with the electrical grid in most of Texas has a lot of people talking about the perils of deregulation, including commentator Walt Rubel.
Everybody loves deregulation until their kid gets sick from drinking the water. And for good reason. Deregulation is always good for business, at least in the short term. Dumping toxic chemicals into the river or onto the ground is always going to be better for the bottom line than safe treatment and disposal. And it's not just business. Government has found that deregulation is a surefire way to increase its own efficiency. A 2013 email from an official at the Michigan Treasurer's Department predicted that switching the Flint water supply off of the Detroit system would save as much as $300 million in the next 25 years. No state has embraced deregulation as tightly as Texas, and no person has extolled its virtues as loudly as former Governor Rick Perry, who, for a precarious 2 years and 9 months, was in charge of protecting the environment for our entire nation. Which is why Texas is the only state in the nation with its own energy grid. If they were connected to the national grid, they'd have to abide by the national regulations. Their way has been a lot more profitable for the energy companies, and cheaper for consumers, until it got cold. A winter storm that swept across the country last week, causing traffic problems and icy sidewalks in other states, knocked out the Texas power grid. Governor Greg Abbott responded by going on Fox News and blaming the Green New Deal. He's now calling for an investigation of the ironically named Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which oversees the power grid, to determine what went wrong and ensure that it never happens again. Here's my prediction. They'll discover that what went wrong is that they didn't winterize the system, even after a similar storm 10 years ago provided ample evidence that they needed to. And the way to prevent it from ever happening again is by winterizing the system. But here's the hard part. That's going to take government mandates, not recommendations. Like all issues involving government, regulation requires balance. I'm not saying more is always better. City and county managers have to always be vigilant for both corruption and arrogance within their inspections and regulations divisions. Getting the balance right requires having different voices at the table. That clearly is not happening in Texas, where the last Democrat to win a statewide election was former Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock in 1994. I'm not sure if it's happening in New Mexico either, where Democrats hold all the statewide offices. There's a heavy cost when we get it wrong.
Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. So great to be with you. Well, to politics now, and a recent survey finds most Texas Republicans still believe false claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election. A University of Houston survey finds 55% of Texans do not believe there was widespread voter fraud in the election, but opinions are split along party lines. 83% of Republicans believe former President Donald Trump's false claims of fraud. 87% of Democrats do not. Hobby School of Public Affairs pollster Mark Jones says Trump remains the most popular GOP leader among Republicans who took that survey last month.
More popular than Ted Cruz and Greg Abbott, and definitely more popular than people like John Cornyn or Dan Patrick or Ken Paxton.
Jones says Trump's popularity may help explain why Governor Greg Abbott declared election integrity an emergency legislative issue despite no evidence of widespread voter fraud. Last March, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces, and every week we are presenting portions of the interviews conducted during the visit. Today, Luciana Herman, whose husband is currently serving in the Army, is interviewed by her friend and mentor, Lauren Rosenberg.
So I wanted to start our conversation by just asking you why you wanted to do this project. What drew you to the Military Voices Initiative?
I believe strongly in talking to other military spouses and learning, and that we as a collective have an incredible experience and that we can learn from each other. And when I found out about the initiative, I was really interested in what's already been archived, and then once I figured out that I could be part of it too, it was very attractive to me given my current research interests, which is to build a multimodal archive, a narrative archive of military family and service life experiences. So I thought this would be a really fun way to foray into my research interest.
What are some of those narratives look like when you, in terms of your kids and your home?
So this actually was born out of, I brought it today, it's born out of a picture that my daughter drew about a week before my husband deployed. He's currently on his fourth deployment. This one is to Afghanistan, and he's been gone since July 27th, and he's slated to come home in the neighborhood of May 1st. And so for about a week before he deploys, I'm a mess. Like, I have all of my crying and all of my, woo-hoo, don't go, and how am I going to do this? We call it the left seat, right seat ride week. So where he, you know, all of the things that he does, if I have any questions about the things that he does in the house, he kind of shows me, plus we had just moved to El Paso about a month before. So he had organized the garage, which was great, but he had to show me where everything was. So in the midst of all of this, he's also packing. And anybody who's ever seen a military member pack for a deployment, it is chaotic at best. They pull out every piece of gear they have. They line it all up because they have packing lists that they're required. And if there's something that they're missing, they have to go out and get it and what have you. And he had everything out on the floor. So I kind of left the house. I went outside in the backyard and I was crying. And I didn't want my kids to see me. And Tom knows the drill. That's my husband, Tom. He knows the drill. So he was like, whatever, lady, just go outside. So my daughter came out and she handed me this piece of paper. And it was folded. And it says, Mom. And she drew the four of us. And she drew my husband wearing his patrol cap, which is the soft cap that he wears with his uniform. And my son is also wearing a patrol cap because my son wants to be in the Army. She was five at the time, very calmly and plainly said to me, don't cry, Mommy, he'll be back. No matter what, we're still a family. And I just thought, well, I'm 35 and I can't deal as well as my kids do. And the day that he left, I was, of course, a mess, and they were fine. And to this day, they're really fine. They understand that what we are doing as a family, specifically what Daddy is doing, is bigger than ourselves. And I think they are inspired daily by that. And it's really quite humbling because there is no better role model for my children than my husband and the people that we surround ourselves with and those who have heeded the call to serve in a very selfless manner. Trauma is almost a foregone conclusion to service members and their family. I mean, not to say that civilians don't undergo trauma.
Right.
But it is a very apparent, and my husband lost soldiers. He lost two soldiers, and one was critically wounded. He was shot in the head, but he survived. We've lost friends. We have lots of friends who deal with PTSD issues daily. Friends who have been medically retired and are now debilitated to the point where they can't work in a conventional setting. So it's not something we harp on, but it's something we're cognizant of. We make sure that our children have the space to ask questions about those types of things.
Before we run out of time, I was just wondering what you can share with others from military families. Like, what about your experience do you think is valuable?
So I think it's valuable to recognize that everybody's experience is different, and it's supposed to be. I think it's really hard to not compare. Something that makes it work for Tom and me, because we're also at the point in our career where a lot of people are choosing to separate, divorce. You know, it puts a terrible strain on your family. But something that makes it work for us is that I am still Luciana and he is still Tom. Let me just make it work.
Tom Herman made it home safely from his last deployment, just a little later than expected, and he will be deploying again this spring. To hear this segment, the full interview, and other StoryCorps segments, go to the StoryCorps page. It's in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their three sanitized homes. More at 525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. Well, some are pushing for the passage of the New Mexico Civil Rights Act, including commentator Peter Goodman.
We need a New Mexico Civil Rights Act because we have no reliable way to enforce our important state constitutional rights. Lawsuits can enjoin state officials from violating your rights, but with no law, there's no recovery of compensatory damages or attorney fees. When cities or counties have to pay damage awards and pay your lawyer's fees, as they do with our Inspection of Public Records and Whistleblower Acts, they sit up and take notice. So do voters, who don't like their money going to you and your lawyer for making the local government do what it should have been doing all along. Change happens that way. For federal constitutional rights, we have a law creating a specific cause of action. But that law, 42 U.S.C. section 1983, meant little until Congress added an attorney fees provision in 1976. With no chance your attorney will get paid, lots of well-merited lawsuits don't happen, and violations of rights continue. The New Mexico legislature is considering such an act, as recommended by the New Mexico Constitutional Commission. They're doing some things right, too, and maybe missing some bets. There's an attorney fees clause. You can recover compensatory damages, but a Senate committee added a $2,000 cap on those, and no punitive damages. I don't like that so much, and the commission was split 5-4, but cities and counties feared huge insurance rates. That commission included Doña Ana County Sheriff Kim Stewart and 3rd Judicial District Attorney Gerald Byers. They've also removed the defense of qualified immunity, which was never in the federal law but was tacked on by courts. It basically means you have to prove that an official not only violated your rights but knew he or she was violating constitutional rights. A reasonable concept, that. But courts have gone crazy. Take our Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. Two cops stealing $250,000 in rare coins during a search would seem a pretty unreasonable seizure. But the judge said that since no previous case had actually held that, there was no constitutional case. If the law says that, the law is an ass, in Mr. Bumble's words. The commission agreed with him, and so has the New Mexico State House of Representatives, although in both bodies the move was also vigorously opposed. I hope our Senate passes the Civil Rights Act soon, but as everyone on all sides keeps warning, don't expect this to be a panacea effecting some sweeping reform of law enforcement.
Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. The New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. The series brings together some of those stories. Public education was challenging in a state as big and diverse as New Mexico. This episode features stories about the everyday realities of rural education, including segregated schools, language barriers, and getting pulled out of school to work on the farm.
Public education was challenging in a state as big and diverse as New Mexico. Work, poverty, religion, and issues of race had different effects on children trying to get educated in the Southwest. Billy Poindexter was born in 1932 in Portales, and his family moved often, usually when the rent was due. He experienced life in rural communities all over the state.
When we lived in Pilar, we went to school, and the schoolhouse was an old church. There was 8 grades in one room. You imagine how much education we got.
Was there one teacher?
One teacher.
Felipe Baca was born in 1928 and spent most of his childhood living in La Cienega and Galisteo. His education would be interrupted during certain times of the year so he could help out on the farm.
We never completed a full term of school because they always took us out of school the month before it ended in the spring or the, you know, in May. They always took us out in April, and then we wouldn't get back until October. So we always missed May and September because that was the time that we were doing all the harvest and the cattle and everything that we had to do. And in April, it's in May, is when all the little lambs are born, you know. This one he took us out of because we used to go out there and our chief, you know. They used to separate him and, you know, depending on when they were born, they can't keep him too long with that. An older lamb and a smaller one, you know, younger one. So we separate him and make a little flock over here and over there and over there. And then each one of us would have to take care of him, you know. So that was a deal for missing school in May and not coming back until October because September was a harvest time.
Larry Gordon was born in 1926 in Oklahoma and moved to New Mexico in 1930. He lived in Page, New Mexico, about 50 yards from the schoolhouse. There was no running water or electricity.
The pump was a force pump about maybe 100 yards away. It had attached to it maybe a 2-inch galvanized pipe with holes in it where the students could, one of them could pump forcibly, and they could stick their face down over the holes in the pipe and get a drink. And we also shared a common drinking cup in the school rooms.
In the first half of the 20th century, segregation in schools was still commonplace as Brown versus the Board of Education, a ruling that helped spark the civil rights movement, would not be passed until 1954. Up next is Lucille Roland Wolf, who was born in Artesia, New Mexico in 1925 and grew up nearby in Atoka. She describes issues minorities faced in southern New Mexico.
A time when we had Mexican workers that the farmers used them to pick the cotton, harvest the crops, and they just had shacks for them to live in. No running water, outdoor toilets, and the kids, the Mexican kids that went to the Mexican school had no way to bathe, and some of them had lice in their hair. And the school teachers would send them to the store to get a quart of kerosene. They used the kerosene to kill the lice in the kids' hair. Of course, most of those little kids didn't speak English, so in the school they had two teachers that had to teach them English and then subjects like writing and spelling and in English. And that school existed until Roosevelt became president, and they had to consolidate the schools. So the Mexican kids went to school with everybody in Artesia.
Her community was a sunset town. This meant that African Americans would need to leave before sunset. Discriminatory laws and intimidation made it so that no protection was offered after hours.
We had no blacks in the community at all, none. If they came in town, they had to leave before the sunset and go someplace else. They were not allowed to stay in the town. After Roosevelt, of course, they could come and stay. But I can remember as a child there in Artesia, kids throwing rocks at the little black kids that were in school.
Francis Beeman was born in 1930 in Lincoln County. He went to grade school in Malaga.
In Malaga, up through, I guess, the fourth grade, were segregated. White kids had one end of the building. The Mexican kids had the other end of the building, and same building. But our playground was on one end, the same end the white kids went to, and their playground's on the other side. And you could not intermingle. And the water fountains, they had one for Hispanics and one for whites. And so it was segregated in the same building.
In the historic 1954 ruling, the Supreme Court banned school segregation of blacks and whites. Segregation would not be outlawed in public places completely until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Luis Cabaldon was born in 1940 and grew up in Irizarry, south of Tejeras, in the 1950s. For a bit of backstory on this next clip, Mr. Carter was a neighbor who Luis referred to as Mr. Stepdad, who he learned a lot from. But when it came time for Luis to learn Spanish, he didn't have anyone in his immediate circle who could teach him.
To learn Spanish, Carter spoke Spanish and a few words in English. And he didn't practice it around me. My grandmother spoke Spanish, nothing in English. Ruth spoke English and Spanish, but there was these ministers, this minister that would come out there, and he'd bring these little books. One book was the book of Matthew, another one might have been the book of another prophet or something. And then he'd take one book and I'd take the other one and read. He'd have me read it in Spanish, or he'd read it in Spanish and I had to follow. And then I'd read it in Spanish and he'd follow and correct me with Spanish. So I started learning Spanish that way. And then with the paper, the New Mexican was written in Spanish back in that at that time. So he'd get a copy of the New Mexican and we'd go through that. He'd have a copy and I'd have a copy. And we're reading through that. And next thing you know, I'm reading Spanish and I'm learning Spanish.
Labeo Martinez was born in 1930 in Dixon, New Mexico. He went to a missionary school where he talks about learning English and his experience attending a mission school.
There was only two schools, the Catholic parochial that was taught by nuns, you know, ladies in the Catholic Church. And I went to the mission school, which was missionary teachers. Most of them were from back east, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, back in New York. Anglo ladies, they came here and had to learn a little Spanish, and that's the way we learned English. Because, I mean, to communicate with a teacher, I had to know a little English, right? And that's the way you learned it. The mission school, they had enough pupils that they went all the way to the eighth grade. By the time I got to the eighth grade, there was no eighth graders, so I went only to the seventh grade.
Okay.
The following year, there was not enough seventh graders, so they made it a what they call an elementary up to sixth grade. So seventh, eighth, and ninth, he went to a school in Santa Fe called Allison James, which was a boarding school and was like what you would call a middle school now. You graduate from the ninth grade.
Okay.
From seventh grade and ninth grade. And if you want to stay with the system, you go to Albuquerque to Menal School and do senior 10th, 11th, and 12th. My parents were Catholic, like everybody else in this town. And we're talking about back in the 1900s. Around 1914 or so, for some reason, the missionary teachers from back east came into town and started the mission school in Dixon. They called it Embudo Puritan Mission School. In my time, it was an honor to graduate from eighth grade, truly. After eighth grade, for some reason, the girls got married and the guys went out and started working the railroad or somewhere. Very few people went to high school. I graduated from high school in 1949, and it was still very, it was better, but it was, for example, my class was only 40 kids.
Labeo mentions that his parents stepped in to help two local boys attend missionary school.
My parents had these two foster boys that their mother had died, and in those days, if you lose one of your parents, you were really an orphan. And the father to the kids worked with my dad in the railroad. So he brought the two little small young boys for my mom to help the father so he could keep working to support him. So, and naturally they started at the parish Catholic school. They opened the mission school and my dad took him out Catholic school across the street to the mission school. This was in poor times when people had their own pew in church. And so we went to church on Sunday, you sat on your own pew. Well, when my dad did that and took out the kids from this side of the street and took them to the other, the next Sunday when he went to school, his bench was out in the porch. So my dad just took the bench home. We still have it.
David Duran was born in Dixon, New Mexico in 1945 in a hospital that was built and run by the Presbyterian Church. He was educated in Presbyterian mission schools and has remained involved throughout his life.
Like all these mission schools, they had their own farms, their own gardens, their own animals for milk, chickens for eggs, things, hogs for meat, sheep for meat, all that. And they usually had acreage. Still had the dairy, still had the hogs, still had the chickens, the farm. So to help pay for my tuition, room and board, tuition, I would work at the farm. I would do things like milk cows at 5 a.m, then go clean a classroom and then go to school, and then practice football or basketball or track or whatever in the afternoon. Summertimes I would stay and work on the farm. We had farming hours. As soon as the sun came up, you went to work and go to bed as soon as the sun was going down.
These mission schools were started largely by missionaries from the East Coast of the United States and were part of a general Protestant expansion in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
The primary reason why they came, the missionaries came out, was to help convert people to their orthodoxy, and they also came as true missionaries. They thought the most important thing they could provide people in the West was an education. Okay, so education meant a lot of things. It was more than just the standard things that you would get in a school, reading, writing, and arithmetic types of things. It was more, life skills, things like courtesies, those types of things that you would learn. Learn discipline, learn respect. You also were being prepared to further your education later on in life. Most of the children who went to mission schools ended up going to higher education, a lot of them did, because the same religious organizations had colleges and universities.
Ann Hoffman and her family were originally from Michigan. They first moved to Arizona and then to New Mexico so that her father could be a missionary. She didn't go to school for 2 years after coming to New Mexico since it was too far away. Instead, she was lent a helping hand from the community.
My family had very little money, so I was the recipient of some very kind acts by mysterious people in town.
Ann is showing her collection of photos during this interview and stops on this particular one of her childhood teacher.
This lovely lady here is Mary Jane Masters, who was my art teacher, my American history teacher, eventually my mystery mother for a year. The women of the Eastern Star would each take one rainbow girl and become her mystery mother, and Mary Jane was mine. And eventually I actually lived first with Mary Jane. And then when she had to have the bed back because her brother was coming from Alaska to visit, she moved me across the street to my geometry teacher, who was the only woman I ever knew who knew anything about math or who could teach me anything about math. And I stayed with her because my mother was hospitalized for a long period of time, and my father had to do his work, and I would have been homeless. But in Farmington at that time, people saw what was needed and stepped up and did it without any fanfare.
We finished this episode with a clip from Clinton Doc West, who was born January 15, 1941. Times were tough for him and his family as they didn't have much money. Clinton's mother would always make his cowboy shirts as well as some of his school attire.
But the embarrassing part of school, my underwear she made out of cotton sacks. I hated going to the gym because everybody had store-bought JCPenney underwear but me. And I had handmade underwear. But you get a little tough with it. We have to wear that to school.
That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino, KRWG Las Cruces, KRXG Silver City.